good horse, I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse.
I feel like if all of us just saw reality, we saw each other as we are, instead of this idea, then a lot of conflict that we see in the world would not exist.
And this we go riding in the damp, foggy.
You're listening to episode 600 of Unwelcome Guests, Evolution Beyond Money. I'm Robin Upton. That was the voice of Daniel Suelo, a resident of Utah, whose words I'm going to be re-listening to because he hasn't touched money for the last decade. We've a very crowded show for you this week. I've had to slightly condense some of the talks. The originals, of course, always still available for download. I'm going to say no more but to introduce Nipun Mehta from TEDx from earlier this year.
I really want to explore the question of what the world would look like if we designed for generosity. This is a cover of Time magazine, May 11, 1953. It features Vinoba Bhave. Vinoba Bhave was named by Gandhi as sort of his official successor. Big shoes to fill in. Now, post-independence in India, Vinoba did something incredible. He realized that there was a lot of inequity in the country, and he wanted to solve it. Sounds a little familiar. And he goes around, so he decides to go on a walking pilgrimage. He goes from village to village, and in each village, he tells the rich landowners to donate 1/6 of their land to the poor landowners. No coercion, no compulsion, just purely for the spirit of generosity. Right? He appealed to their inner transformation. He ended up walking 70,000 kilometers. And through those 70,000 kilometers, more than 5 million acres of land was just donated. 5 million acres, that's bigger than the size of Kuwait. That's twice the size of Lebanon. That's almost as big as Israel. And all he did was he would go from in a village, inspire these people, and go on to the next. It ended up being the largest peaceful transfer of land in human history. But what was the force? What was the underlying inner transformation that allowed him to do it? A lot of us have been thinking about these kinds of questions, and there isn't really a word. So we came up with a word. We call it giftivism. The practice of radically generous acts that changed the world. Now, giftivism is different. What you see over there, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, Cesar Chavez, you go on down the list, they're all practicing giftivism. And the marker of giftivism is that it's for the 100%. There is no enemy, there is no opponent, because ultimately, our inner transformation is tied to the outer manifestation. All these people recognize that. And that's giftivism. So how can we bring about, naturally, we ask this question, how can we have more of this in the world? So the key question for us was, what designs emerge if we assume that people want to behave selflessly? So by designs, it's institutions, systems, projects. What would emerge if we turned this question on its head? And by on its head, I mean, you know, if you look at economics, right? It's built on the premise that people aim to maximize self-interest. That's the basic fundamental building block of all economics, is that we are selfish. What happens if you turn that around and say, well, actually, maybe people want to be selfless? So a few of us, back in April 1999, went to a homeless shelter. We said, we want to give, just for the love of it. We don't know what we want to do, but we want to help. We came back and we ended up building them a website. Felt great, so we told all our friends about it. Says, hey, this generosity thing, there's really something to it. And all of a sudden, they're like, okay, sounds good. And they come in, and they experience the same thing, and they told their friends, and it started growing. It was very counterculture at the time, because we easily could have made money doing it. But we were saying, we weren't just looking for money. We were saying that there's this inner transformation, which is actually beyond money, almost priceless. So we then looked at it. We had a very interesting thing happen. There was a .com that went belly up. And when it went belly up, they came to us and they said, hey, can you keep our product alive? Because it's doing a lot of civic good. We said, sure. We'd be happy to. We can try. We were a bunch of volunteers. We didn't know if we could actually run an organization like that. In 3 months, we doubled all their numbers. We scratched our heads. We said, oh, man, we got institutional capacity. We could do stuff. So then we said, well, what should we do? Well, we should do what no one else is willing to do. Like what? Well, we should do things that like good news. CNN doesn't put any good news, but if you don't have good news in the world, you're constantly going to be stuck in the fear narrative. Why doesn't CNN have good news? It's very hard to monetize. Then we said, well, maybe there's other things, right? So we started a portal for good news, and then we said, well, what about kindness? Again, very hard to monetize. Doesn't mean we shouldn't have systematic efforts to promote that kind of stuff in the world. So we started a portal to do that. And we started a whole bunch of different projects. And then at some point, we said, why not go offline? What happens if you run a restaurant in this way? What happens if you run a rickshaw in India in this way? What happens if you run an art magazine in this way? Right? In this way, by which I mean the power of generosity, the power of inner transformation. So what ended up happening was that we actually created a whole ecosystem called Service Space around this kind of an idea. Now, all innovation, if you look at it, is bound by these creative constraints that you put on yourself. So we had three very interesting, curious constraints. The first was we decided that we were going to be all volunteer run. And you say, okay, well, that's interesting. So instead of, you know, having five staff working 40 hours a week, we said we're going to have 40 volunteers contributing 5 hours a week. So same amount of output at the end of the day, but an incredible amount of energy, right? What we started unleashing was the power of compassion capital. The second big thing was that we didn't fundraise. We saw a lot of amazing projects. You know, they start out with noble, beautiful intentions. By the 10th year, they're all bogged down in fundraising. By the 20th year, it's like before you do something, you got 20 photographers showing what you're going to do. And this was just the sad truth of organizing. So we said, is there another way? We don't know, but let's experiment. Let's not fundraise. What that meant was that instead of showing value, we were just focused on adding value. We were doubling down on adding value. And that allowed us to discover all kinds of untapped, undiscovered capital. And the third thing was that we were honoring the process, which meant honoring small acts. And small acts were great, but when they really got connected to each other, we realized that there was a synergy that was happening, where 1 + 1 was greater than 2, the whole was greater than the sum of the parts. And you have two things. By themselves, there are two things. But when you put them together, there's a bond, and that bond actually means something. That bond actually has value. And so we started seeing synergistic capital. So we had these three constraints, but it ended up allowing us to flourish with all kinds of different abundance, if you want to call it that. So these small acts of giftivism, when they get connected, it rekindles a gift economy. A gift economy is, of course, very different than a traditional economy because in a gift economy, it's the circulation of these gifts that leads to the vitality of society, not hoarding, not accumulation. Such a gift culture is marked by these four key shifts. The first one is a shift from consumption to contribution. An average American sees 3,500 ads a day, mostly unconsciously. So 3,500 ads a day that are telling you are incomplete as you are. You need my product, you need my service, before you can be complete. So it's very hard to come out of this consumption conditioning, but what if we flip it? What if we open each door and say, what can I give? Instead of saying, what can I get, what can I give? If you start with that, it really changes the whole game. To encourage that, we started a little game called Smile Cards. Now, Smile Cards are these business-sized wallet cards. You know, you have them in your pocket, and you do a small act of kindness anonymously, and you leave a smile card behind. It tells the recipient that you don't know who did this for you, but keep the chain going. You can do that for someone else. Sure, the classic example is paying toll for the car behind you. And that's great. But what happens when you are that car behind you? Do you pay forward for the person after you? So Smile Cards becomes an invitation. And imagine if we spread this in all corners of the world. Right? So what happens when you start to look at the world in that way? We look at all the things we receive and ask the question, how can I pay forward and keep the chain going? That's the shift from consumption to contribution. The second shift is from transaction to trust. You can't shake hands with a clenched fist. So to experiment with this, we started a little project that perhaps lots of you know about because there's a restaurant here in Berkeley that I'm going to talk about. It's Karma Kitchen. Karma Kitchen, you walk into Karma Kitchen and you have a meal like you do at any other restaurant, but your check at the end of the meal reads zero. Now it's zero because someone before you paid for your meal and you get to pay forward for people after you. You can imagine the business school folks scratching their heads saying, wait a second, you know, how the heck can that work? You mean you just trust people? You know, that's not what we were taught in school. And we ourselves didn't know how long it was going to continue. We just started it as an experiment. We said, let's see how long the chain continues. It's been 4 years, 26,000 meals. People continue to pay it forward. Spread to D.C. and Chicago, and actually all over the world now. So there was a very interesting, I mean, amazing things happen at Karma Kitchen. But there was a very, there was a professor right here at the Haas School of Business, Leif Nelson, who says, we got to study this. Something's going on, you know. So they decide to do an experiment. They go to a cartoon museum. It's a dollar to get into the cartoon museum. And they said, today you get to pay what you want. But put whatever you want in that box. People on average give $1.23. Pretty amazing. But then they went one step further, and they said, instead of putting pay what you want in that box, pay directly to the cashier, but still whatever you want. Now, all of a sudden, it humanizes the whole interaction. People on average paid $2. Then they said, let's do Karma Kitchen style and evoke their interconnection. Someone before you has paid for your tab, and you get to pay forward for people after you. These people who are never even going to be able to look at you in the face and say thank you. How much would you pay? On average, people gave over $3. So we have to count on people to be generous. When you count on people to be generous, all kinds of beautiful things can happen. The third shift is a shift from isolation to community. Now, community isn't just people coming together. It's how are people coming together. Context really matters. You take a look at a piece of graphite and a piece of diamond made of the same carbon atoms. But the only difference is how the carbon atoms are configured, how they connect, how they bond. That makes all the difference in what the end product is, what the manifestation is. So we have to really start to cultivate these deeper ties. This is a photo of my 10-year-old cousin. Now, Neil, on his 10th birthday party, he decides to throw, you know, a super soaker party. They all have fun in the back. And then in the afternoon, he does something different. He says, I'm going to invite all my friends and we're going to do a free car wash for the community. So they had their board and their jingle and they all these strangers pulled up on the driveway. They split up into, you know, the pre-rinse team and the soap team and the rinse team and the tire team, and they were just going at it. Now imagine if you're pulling up in one of these cars. The people come out of the car and they're completely bowled over. They're like, what are you doing this for? Is this a fundraiser? That's amazing. I'd like to contribute. They said, no, we're not doing this for a fundraiser. We're actually just practicing generosity. And that kind of stuff can really blow you away. All the guards are down. All of a sudden, it's like, yeah, I love you, man. And they're like, oh. They're taking photos. And these kids, you know, it was amazing to see the connection between these strangers and the kids. But what was even more amazing was how these kids bonded because they served other people together. So you can be Facebook friends, and those loose ties have its value. You can go out to movies with your friend, and those deep ties have their values. But you can serve others together, and that creates gift ties, and those are priceless. Those are really valuable. So we need to cultivate a network of these gift ties. And the last shift is a shift from scarcity to abundance. This is really a mindset. It's a mindset of tapping into enough. Right? Whenever you say abundance, people look at that and say, well, do you really think there's plenty for everybody? And I think Gandhi tackles it spot on in one sentence. He says, there is enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. So how do we tap into this mindset of enough? What you see a photo on their top over there are two giftivism warriors, love warriors, if you want to call them. They live in East Oakland. You might have seen the photo. This is at Occupy Oakland. They went to jail for meditating. They're completely peaceful. Now, these guys actually do a lot of amazing, interesting stuff. They have a house on the border of two gangs in East Palo Alto, one of the worst places in the country. Most people say there's a lot of scarcity. They have scarcity of safety, they have scarcity of resources, they have all kinds of scarcities. These guys are saying, look, we have enough. Let's look at this with new eyes and see what we can give to other people. They live on Fruitvale Avenue. Lots of fruits there still. And they decided they would connect with their neighbors, and they say, look, you have all these amazing fruits. They're going to waste. Can we just pluck them and gift them? Neighbors are like, yeah, sure. Are you guys going to do that? That's great. They become friends. They go out to people and say, here is organic, fresh, ultra-local orange for you. And it's a gift from your neighbors in East Oakland. These are not just people on the receiving end that just need to get. They are now contributing. They reframe the whole equation. And like that, they're doing so many different activities, all because they tapped into this mindset of abundance. So in conclusion, I mean, you know, here are the four shifts, right? When we move from consumption to contribution, we appreciate what we receive and we pay forward. When you move from transaction to trust, you really start to rely on our interconnectedness in a very deep, profound way. When you go from isolation to community, you start to cultivate this network of gift ties. And when you move from scarcity to abundance, you really start to discover your gifts and start to experience this generative power of gratitude. It's very generative. So that's really giftivism. It's the practice of radically generous acts that change the world. But it's not just reserved for the Gandhis and the Mother Teresas and the Dalai Lamas of the world. In the bottom right over there is this man that most of you may not have heard of. His name is Julio Diaz. Everyday Joe. He lives in New Jersey. Every day he takes the subway back home. And one day he's getting off, and this kid comes up to him with a knife, and he says, "Give me all your money." He says, "Okay, well, here's my wallet." He gives it to him. Kid's about to run off, and then he yells out at the kid, "Hey, kid, it's a little cold. Do you want my jacket too?" The kid's blown away. He hadn't learned this in Robbery 101, so he comes back. And he says, okay, yeah, all right. But now when he comes back, very different energy. Right? They start to connect. They start to bond. And Julio says, "I'm about to go have dinner. Do you want to join me?" Also not in Robbery 101. So they go to dinner, and they have this profound conversation. At the end of dinner, Julio says, "I'd love to treat you, but you have my wallet." So the kid naturally takes out his wallet and gives it back to Julio. And at that point, Julio says, "Can I ask for one more thing? Can I have your knife too?" And very easily, very naturally, he gives it back to him. That is giftivism, because Julio tapped into that spirit of inner transformation, says, "This is not a guy who is taking stuff from me. I just want to blow him away." And that capacity, blow him away with generosity. Underneath that generosity is an inner transformation. And once we tap into that inner transformation, all kinds of new possibilities are available to us. As we say in Service Space, our tagline says, change yourself, change the world. If we make that inner change, outer change is bound to come in a very different way if it comes from the inside out.
And now we're going to hear an interview of Daniel Suelo and his friend and biographer, Mark Sundin. This is by Doug Fabrizio of KUER's Radio West from March 12, 2012.
So here are the first few lines of Mark Sundin's new book. In the first year of the 21st century, a man standing by a highway in the middle of America pulled from his pocket his life savings, $30. He laid it inside a phone booth and he walked away. For 12 years now, Daniel Suelo has lived his life without credit or barter or government handouts, without money. Mark Sundin's book traces the path of Suelo's life, his extreme lifestyle, his philosophy that comes behind it, but he also explores his own feelings about the things that in life that really matter. Mark Sundin is joining us today to talk about his book. It's called The Man Who Quit Money. Mark Sundin is the author of a number of books, including Car Camping and The Making of Toro. His writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Believer, McSweeney's, and Outside Magazine. And he's joining us here in the studio. Mark Sundin, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to start with how you met Daniel, first of all, because you write about this in the book. You knew him before he had ditched the idea of money.
Yeah. I'd met him almost 20 years ago down in Moab.
Right.
And we were working together as cooks in a restaurant. And we'd had a similar life, I would say, in that we'd both been to college and had ideas of a career. He'd actually been in the Peace Corps as well. He's a few years older than me. But we didn't see anything we wanted to do as a career. We didn't want to, you know, climb the ladder, join the rat race. And so we'd gone to Moab, which, is, as you probably know, is a great place to lose your ambition for a while.
So even then, you shared a kind of connection. I mean, how do you explain the relationship that you have with him? Kindred spirits, sort of?
Yeah, and I mean, the interesting part, of course, is that we were leading a pretty similar life back then. I was living in my car. Daniel was eventually decided to live in a cave one summer because he didn't want to pay rent. And, you know, we've diverged pretty drastically since then.
There's a story you tell. He went off on his way. You went off on your way. And at some point, you encountered him again in Moab. You say you barely recognized him at first. He had bad teeth. And you say that that made you ashamed. And a sentiment which you say in the book made you mad.
Yeah. I had heard from mutual friends that Daniel had stopped using money. And I thought, oh, well, he obviously just went crazy, because why else would anyone stop using money?
Yeah.
And then I ran into him one day somewhere in Moab, and I had kind of repressed this memory until I started writing the book, but it was there like a thorn in my side or in my shoe. And finally it came back to me, and I'd seen him across this market, and I kind of looked at him. He looked like he'd aged. His hair was gray. You know, I hadn't seen him in years. He had a gray beard, and he used to be very clean shaven. And he smiled at me, and he was missing a tooth. And I immediately basically turned away and walked out of the store as if I didn't know him, didn't even acknowledge him. And you know, this is something I'm not really proud of, because I like to think of myself as a good person who's nice to everyone, even if they have a tooth missing. But I realized that knowing he lived without money and then seeing him, I thought, you know, what right does he have to have bad teeth in America? This is the richest country in the history of civilization. And when I saw that, it felt like, you know, I was ashamed of how much I had. And I felt mad at him, and I just walked out of the store.
Wait, what do you make of that? I have to say, your reaction is similar to, there's an article about the book in The Atlantic.
Yeah, that's an excerpt.
An excerpt from it in The Atlantic. And going through some of the comments are really interesting, because they reflect in some ways the way you were – a part anyway of what you were feeling. Let me read some of these, because I think they're interesting. Not practical at all, and seems pretty pointless. His existence seems subsidized by freeloading on others. The guy is a glorified leech. And it kind of goes on and on like that. Celebrating someone who runs away from life is not something that I would do. They say he might as well jump off a cliff or go into the wilderness and starve himself to death like Chris McCandless, which was the character real life person that chronicled in John Krakauer's book. But what do you make of that kind of reaction? People are pretty passionate about this. They're pretty dismissive. But do you sense the kind of anger that you were feeling at that time?
Yeah, you know, now that I know Daniel well, it blows me away, and I feel pain that people are judging him so quickly. But I know that I did the same at one point in my life, and so I can kind of relate to these people. But nonetheless, I am just amazed at the amount of anger and fear that he inspires in people who I would probably get along with. I mean, I've been talking about Daniel to people who were, you know, Peace Corps volunteers, the type of people I think who would really
relate to it.
People who've spent time in the third world, people who've lived with less, and they say, well, what's he giving back? Mm. You know, what is he contributing to society? Mm. And how dare he? And it's amazing. People across political persuasions have a nerve that gets touched.
Why? What do you make of it? What is it?
I can't speak for everyone, but for myself, I think, you know, we all make compromises with our financial system.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you're a Christian and you know that deep down you're not following the actual teachings of Jesus. Or maybe you're a liberal and you pay your taxes proudly, and yet when you see a homeless person, you walk to the other side of the street and you don't give them any money and you don't make eye contact. Because we've learned that you don't have to do that. And when we see someone who's proving that you can actually live without money, it makes us think, oh, wow, I've made some compromises and I don't actually live according to my own beliefs the way I thought I did. Mm. It's what it did for me anyway.
You write about the fact that in some way you were completely different from Daniel in this sense. You say you'd always really liked money. and I suppose most of us do, but you write about a particular kind of affection. Collecting,
right.
You know.
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, you know, I had this grandmother who always gave me coins. And my brother and I would collect them and put them in the little tubes and roll them up and take them to the bank. And, you know, our passbook account savings would go from $13 to $17 to $21. And I loved it. Hmm. And even though I lived a really, what I thought of as an unmaterialistic life up into my 30s, I mean, all of my possessions could fit in the back of my truck for years. I still loved the game of saving money. I still loved the idea, if I got something for cheap, then I was working the system, you know, I was winning. And I still do that. You know, if I go out and find a car that's $2,000 below Blue Book, I think it's great. And I love a lot of parts of capitalism.
Well, I guess it's pretty apparent, but talk about just how our lives are dependent on money, because you write about this in the book. You say our national identity is enmeshed with the idea of private property.
Yeah, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution says we can't be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law. And, you know, placing property alongside life and liberty, that's amazing. That's a brand new invention in human civilization, or at least it's only a couple hundred years old. People and cultures survived without any concept of private property for thousands of years. I mean, when the white people showed up in America, the Indians didn't think you could own land any more than you could own the sunlight or the air. So this is a relatively new idea for humans, and yet here in America, we embrace it like a law of physics. If you fall off the roof, if you step off the roof, you'll fall to the ground. If you don't pay your rent, you'll get evicted. You're not going to have an argument with your landlord or with a judge or with the sheriff who comes to evict you. End of story. You know, if you don't pay, you're out. Because we're so deep in it, I don't think we realize that there's another way of doing it.
When did you figure not only that you wanted to find him, talk to him, ask him questions, but maybe even write a book about him? I mean, how did that evolve?
Well, Daniel has been talking about the idea that money is an illusion for 12 years now, since 2000, when the economy was booming. And no one paid him any attention. Of course, you know, he lived in a cave. But after 2008, a lot of people said, hey, you know what, maybe money is an illusion. I mean, trillions of dollars disappeared overnight. Let's say your house was worth $500,000 one day. The next day it was worth $300,000. And you said, what happened to that 200 grand that I had?
Yeah.
People's pensions disappeared. And so at that point, someone a Moab writer named Christopher Ketchum did a story about Suelo. I think the tagline was, you think you're going to have to live without money? Well, here's someone who does.
Yeah.
And suddenly I started reading his blog, his website. I didn't realize at that point that Suelo had a blog or website. I hadn't talked to him in years, although we were Facebook friends. And I said, oh my God, this guy has got some good points. And this guy has in some way been prophetic about the economy. He's been saying all along, you know, this money's not real. And so I said, you know, I think a lot of people are feeling this too, because all of a sudden, you know, we're out of work, our houses are worth less than we paid for them, and our pensions are worth nothing. So I went looking for him.
Principally lives in these canyons. He finds these caves in canyon lands, and he lives there. And of course, it's technically illegal.
It's legal for 14 days.
14 days.
And then after that, it's illegal. You're supposed to move, I think, 30 miles away, which is hard if you don't have a car.
Here's a moment in the book where he has, I'm not sure if it's the first confrontation, but he has a confrontation with a ranger. And I think it just expresses sort of what his life is like and his reaction to, I guess, the realities of day-to-day life.
In the fall of 2002, 2 years after quitting money, Suelo homesteaded a majestic alcove high on a cliff, 200 feet across and 50 feet tall. Its sculpted mouth was windblown into smooth symmetry. Sitting inside and gazing into the gorge below felt like heralding himself to the world from inside the bell of a trumpet. Suelo's grotto was a two-hour walk from pavement, and believing he was unlikely to be disturbed, he settled in for the long haul. He chipped at the rocky ground to create a wide flat bed and lined it with tarps and pads and sleeping bags that had been left out with someone else's trash. He stacked rocks to block the wind and built wood-burning cook stoves from old tin cans. He learned to forage for cactus pods, yucca seeds, wildflowers, and the watercress that grew in the creek. From dumpsters, he stockpiled dry goods like rice and beans and flour and sealed them in plastic buckets. He drank from springs, bathed in the creek. He washed his clothing by wading it overnight with the river rock, dried it on the hot sandstone. He arranged on stone slabs a library of books. From a chunk of talus, he carved a statue, a ponderous head like some monolith from Easter Island. In warm months, the cave attracted occasional hikers, and when Suelo was away, he left a note. It said, "Feel free to camp here. What's mine is yours. Eat any of my food, read my books, take them with you if you'd like." Visitors left notes in return, saying they were pleased with his caretaking. Then one day, after several years of peace, a ranger from the Bureau of Land Management arrived to evict him. Suelo had long since violated the 14-day limit. If I were hiking along here and I saw this camp, said the ranger, I'd feel like I wasn't allowed here, that it was someone else's space. But this is public land. And Suelo said, are you saying this because you're paid to say it or because you really believe it? Well, I do have to keep my personal and my professional opinions separated, said the ranger, but you are making a high impact here. Suelo said, who do you think is making a higher impact on the earth, you or me? The ranger wrote a ticket for $120. Well, I don't use money, Suelo said, so I can't pay this. Not only did he not use money, he had discarded his passport and driver's license. He had even discarded his legal surname, Schellenberger, in favor of Suelo, which is Spanish for soil. He chose the name spontaneously back in his tree-sitting days in Oregon when he caught sight of a sticker that said, all soil is sacred. Suelo has stuck.
It's Mark Sandin. He's reading from his book, The Man Who Quit Money. You mentioned how tempting it is to see Daniel as someone who is wanting to save the earth. That's why he's doing this. He wants to sort of decrease his footprint. But you say that's not really his primary mission.
No, before he quit money, he was already living with such a low footprint that in some ways this was an almost negligible difference. You know, when he still had a job and paid taxes and paid his student loans, he had decided to go off and live in these canyons just because he loved being outside and he was trying to pay off his student loans instead of paying rent. So, of course, having a low impact is part of it, but there's a much, I'd say, deeper reasons for doing it.
What? I mean, because it's the rejection of a system. That's what it's about, it seems.
Well, it's a rejection, but it's also an embrace. Ultimately, to him, this is a better way of life.
Rejection of one system and the embrace of another.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. To him, this is a way that is a more meaningful life, less anxious, less striving, less worrying about stuff and status. So I guess what he's rejected is our economic system. He thinks it's unfair and unjust. He has the same criticism of the Federal Reserve Bank that you'll hear from the Tea Party. He has the same criticism that our government is controlled by corporations that you'd hear from the Occupy movement. Mm. And his idea is direct civil disobedience. He's an absolute boycott. I mean, this is called freeganism by some people. Daniel doesn't really belong to any movement, but, you know, it's an absolute boycott. And what he's embraced, I would say, is a spiritual path that, you know, as a lifelong religious person who's studied all the scriptures of all the religions, he's determined that the teachings from Jesus to Buddha to Krishna to Muhammad to Gandhi and Thoreau is this idea of non-attachment or non-possession, that you give up some of the material world for a more satisfying spiritual life.
You write about one particular lapse he has. So he gets $500 back on his taxes, and he gets invited to a friend's wedding in, was it Florida?
He was in Florida, and the wedding was here in Utah.
Back here in Utah. Okay. So he really, this seems so completely out of character. He splurges, pays the deposit on a Mercedes-Benz sports car.
Right.
A convertible.
Right.
And makes his way from Florida back here.
Right. So at this point, this was in 2001. He had been without money for 6 months. And, you know, he had never made a vow that he was going to do this for the rest of his life. Yeah. It was an experiment.
Right.
And he'd done it for 6 months.
He calls it an experiment in an email he sent out to his friends. Which
absolutely.
Is interesting.
Yeah. And after 6 months, he was on the East Coast living in an intentional community. And he got this tax refund for $500 that had been floating around. You know, he didn't have an address at that point. His parents had got it and they'd sent it to him. And so he said, you know what? Experiment's off for now. And what he did was this drive-away car program where some person has a car they want moved across the country. And, you know, it's basically a barter. You drive their car and they let you use the car. So he paid the $500, and I believe he got the $500 back when he safely delivered the car in Santa Fe or something like that. So the experiment was off, and he still had the $500. He spent it all over the course of a couple months. And then he said, you know what? I liked it better without money. This money feels like a ball and chain. And he got rid of that, and he hasn't used any since.
That was the last time.
Yeah.
So if he uses the word experiment, I mean, that's how he was thinking about it at the time. It's not an experiment anymore. Or is it?
I think it is. He still doesn't make a vow that he's going to do it for the rest of his life.
Really?
Yeah. And he's been really influenced by Gandhi's book, Experiments with Truth. And so he sees everything as an experiment. And, you know, for him, this is all about freedom. Living without money feels like it's made him more free.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to make a vow or a promise that would curtail his freedom. So he's not, he doesn't say, I'm going to do this forever. You know, he might change his mind someday, but.
So he, in that way, he's not a monk.
Exactly. Yeah. A monk typically makes a lifelong.
There's not a vow.
A lifelong vow of poverty. And no, he's not a monk. Partially because he doesn't, perhaps you might say he wouldn't belong to any club that would accept him as a member.
He's
an independent, free spirit. But also, he doesn't want to sit on a mountaintop and attain enlightenment and let the world burn. He's really engaged in the world. That's why he has a blog. That's why he talks about this stuff. And you know, he gets a lot of criticism, like these people you were talking about from online. You know, they say, well, if you're really free from the system, why don't you not use the internet? And that's not his thing. He's not trying to be self-sufficient. He's not trying to be independent from the system. He's simply trying to not use money. And as such, he's absolutely engaged in the politics down in southern Utah. He volunteers, he works, he sees friends. He hasn't given up much outside of money.
In the book, Mark Sandine, you sort of trace the origins of this life philosophy. And it seems like one part of the understanding all of this is his upbringing. He's raised in a family of, you describe them as religious idealists. They're sort of religious fundamentalists.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're Christian fundamentalists and the type who were actually doing missionary work and were really trying to follow the teachings of Jesus to the letter. Converting people, leading Bible studies, and
very literal interpretation of the Bible,
and taking in poor people
who
need a place to sleep. They would bring them into the house, and so yeah, a very idealistic interpretation of Christianity.
There's this important moment in Daniel's life. He's young. His family is part of this congregation in this working class Denver neighborhood. 1969, you say it was on a Sunday. And Daniel sees this exchange between this couple in his church who had arrived in a Cadillac.
Right.
And this vagabond, this guy who walks by, the hippie, as they called him.
Right.
So tell that story.
Yes. Yeah, so this couple that in the Cadillac, I believe they had maybe donated one of the buildings to the church. They were very well off. And Daniel and his family, he had three brothers and a sister. They were getting out of their car. And as this hippie walked past, he said to this very rich couple, "You know, are you serving God or are you serving money?" And then he walked off. And this couple who were, you know, donated the building to the church, they were very offended. And but Daniel, already at that young age, I think he was 8, he had already read the Bible. He knew about Jesus asking people to give up their possessions and that it was more difficult for a rich man to get into heaven than for a camel to squeeze through a needle. I have a needle.
Yeah.
So he said to his father, you know, who was that guy and why did he say that and was he right?
Right.
And his father said, oh, he's just a hippie. He doesn't understand anything. He's just a heathen.
But it stayed with Daniel, that story.
It stuck with him over the years, yeah. And he, his entire life, I think, has been in some ways a struggle to understand some of Jesus's teachings in ways that didn't make sense to him from a very young age.
But he arrives at the at school, the University of Colorado in Boulder, 1981. You describe him, he hasn't changed his name, of course, and he votes for Reagan. He's a preppy who worked with the Campus Crusade for Christ.
Yeah, he penned an editorial for the newspaper talking about how communists were a great threat. He was a very, you know, what nowadays is called the religious right.
He was a part of that. And he's studying the Bible in college, and you write about this thing where he strikes upon this idea, the concept of wisdom in the Old Testament. And he sees wisdom personified as a woman. And this gets him thinking, and it hits him, you write, that we're not supposed to focus on the dominant thing, but the recessive thing. So not the eagle, but the sky. Not the ship, but the seas. Not the man, but the maiden. What is that he strikes upon?
Well, It's a, I mean, some might call it a feminist interpretation of Christianity. He at the time was also studying Taoism in his world religion classes, and he said, oh, this is actually kind of what they're talking about in Eastern religions, that it's, you know, he always thought that Christianity was such a male-dominated religion. You have the Father and the Son, you have the Holy Ghost, and, you know, most of the biblical figures are men, and it's very patriarchal. And here he was finding something more like Taoism, like this idea that, you know, it's not the pot, it's the vacancy inside of the pot. Mm-hmm. It's not the wheel, it's the spoke in the middle. And that just really got him thinking about that maybe what he'd been taught in Christianity wasn't not quite what he thought.
And then he meets a professor at the university, Brian Mahan, who has a really powerful influence on over Daniel. And his, as you write in the book, at this point, his fundamentalism is pretty rattled. What influence was Professor Mahan on the way, on the man he finally became, I guess?
Mahan was a Catholic, and he was interested in liberation theology, this idea that Jesus was a revolutionary who would have been at home in a social movement today, you know, of the poor people fighting against the injustice of the ruling class. And so I'd say that Mahan opened his idea to the fact that maybe Christianity could be a social justice movement. Daniel said to me once, he said, but until then I never realized that you could be a Democrat and a Christian.
Wow. I wonder, I want to ask you about this moment that you write about. Daniel is driving in Mount Evans. It's the spring. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not sure if we need to set this up. I mean, the story itself sort of speaks for itself. You want to say something?
Yeah, I'll set it up a little bit. You know, when he was discovering this feminine side of Christianity, was at the same moment in his life where he was realizing he was gay.
Yeah.
And this was pretty hard to be a fundamentalist and come from a fundamentalist family. He went down to Ecuador, spent 2 years in the Peace Corps, finally came out to his family, and it was a really shattering event. Very difficult within his family, very difficult within his faith, and started to think of himself as an atheist for a brief period, and fell into what he now recognizes as a clinical depression. So he was working as a social worker in Denver when this picks up. At 3 in the morning, Suelo dresses and starts the sedan. He takes the highway into the Rockies, the same evergreen range where his father broke horses and quartered his mother. He exits at the Mount Evans Road and winds up into the mist. It's spring, and the asphalt is wet from the packs of dirty snow clinging to the mountainside. He knows his destination. He can picture it. The road narrows and grows steeper. Now, with the black night turning gray, he can see an icy lake so far below it looks like a puddle. His is the only car on the road. What kind of lunatic would be driving up Mount Evans at this hour, he thinks, and gets a laugh out of that. He steers to the precipice and peers over. A quick drop-off, then a steep slope of boulders, the tips of wild grasses poking through the snow, and the big free fall, hundreds of feet down to the lake. He makes a note of the spot. The shoulder is crumbling into the abyss, and steel girders prop it up. He drives to the pullout and turns around, preparing for a final approach. His heart leaps to his throat. And then, as he points the wheel toward the edge, something emerges from the fog. It's an animal. 2, 3, more. Is he hallucinating? No, it's a herd of mountain goats, with their knobby knees and white fur and spiked horns. The goats have descended the slope opposite the drop-off and are making their way up the road. One approaches the car. Daniel rolls down the window. Man and beast look into each other's eyes. The goat has wet, black, compassionate eyes, 2 saucers of oil. And Daniel feels oddly comforted, as if the animal has given him permission to do what he's about to do. He punches the gas. The car jerks toward the cliff, Daniel thinks, if God has some purpose for me, then not even I can resist it. The rocks scrape beneath as he launches, then blackness.
It's a dramatic moment, of course, but you say the crash assumes an almost supernatural importance for Daniel. And his life, and this is how you put it in the book, begins to resemble an ordered fable. What do you mean?
Well, as I was working on this book, I started reading Joseph Campbell and The Hero with a Thousand Faces Thinking about this idea of the heroic journey, because I couldn't really make sense of Daniel's life in terms of economics or politics or even modern-day religion. And I'm thinking, like, this is a guy that goes out into the desert, gives away all his possessions, lives in a cave, goes against everything in society that we've come to believe. And furthermore, there's this event where he attempts suicide, and then by what would seem to be a miracle,
finds
himself back at the top of the cliff. The car tumbles a couple hundred feet down, lodges up against a rock at the very edge of the precipice, and he's saved. And Daniel, I asked him about this, and he said, it was the first time I felt the hand of God, and I hated it, because he had thought that he could get out of this life. You know, this life didn't work for him, and he was going to get out of it. And to him, this was God telling him, oh, no, you don't. You know, you got to make sense of it while you're still alive. And that was in 1990 or 91. So it took him 10 years from that point to where he gave up money. But that was, where it began. That was where Hero's journey began. He said, okay, here's what I need to do. I need to find meaning in life. And he went out and he found it.
Also with us in the studio now is Daniel Suelo, the subject of Mark's new book. Daniel Suelo, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Human beings have always exchanged things, you know, given one thing for another thing. You know, in another time we bartered, you know, grain for in exchange for something. And I'm wondering, what's wrong with the money system? What has changed, do you think, that makes it corrupt?
Well, I don't really necessarily believe money itself is evil. And I kind of feel like it's part of our evolution, something we have to go through, but I envision it going obsolete. That's something we have to move away from. Another thing that motivated me to live without money was just observing nature and how this infinite universe functions without money, and how does it function without money. And we believe that our money system is the universe, and we can't imagine, we don't allow our minds to think outside this little box. It's actually quite small compared to the infinite universe. And just like observing, like anything, like you take fruit from a tree, like an apple from a tree, the tree demands nothing back. So how does this tree get what it needs back? The point is it doesn't worry and you don't worry. You don't have any sense of obligation taking the fruit. The tree has no sense of its consciousness of credit and debt. Yeah. Neither I or the tree has consciousness of credit and debt. And it's when we start worrying about the balance, the natural balance of positive and negative of nature, like nature takes care of it.
Right.
Every positive is going to be met with a negative and vice versa. So
right.
Why do we think we have to control it? And this is the way the money system works. It's a lack of faith in this process of nature. And if we look at, if we just look around us, we can see the evidence. We see that no commercial civilization on Earth knows how to balance its budget, even with our PhD economists. And yet nature is balanced. Why is it balanced? And you don't see any two animals with this idea of, okay, I'm going to give you this if you give me that.
Right, right.
It happens naturally, like barter happens naturally, but nobody's conscious of it. And to me, this goes to the core of the teachings of all the world religions, that you give expecting nothing in return. And the idea that God controls credit and debt, like vengeance is mine, I will repay.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't think about this stuff, but this is actually the core of our spiritual traditions, which few of us think about.
Is it faith?
Yeah, it's exactly faith. Like, I feel like everything in nature runs on faith.
Yeah.
And faith to me isn't a belief system. It's a trust. It's a trust in the
cycles of nature.
And completely then submitting to it, just giving into it completely.
Yeah, that submission, which in Arabic is Islam. It's total submission to, you trust that everything you need is going to come when you need it, whether it's good or bad. It's like you accept it. And this is what animals in nature do, and plants, and air, everything.
It's interesting. I wonder if do you give yourself certain rules? I mean, you say, I'm not going to accept money. I'm not going to do that. But do you impose certain rules on your existence, or do you try to be more sort of free-flowing in the way you live? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's more free-flowing. But I do find myself putting rules on myself, and I almost feel like the rules are a little doorway out of the rules, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Like I don't know how to explain it, but it's like...
That's the point, right? It's hard to explain.
Yeah, it's like my rule is to live free.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. But let me ask you this. What stresses you out?
Not really that much. Sometimes I find myself worrying about what people are thinking. And I think that's bottom line, our biggest obstacle, just not following our hearts. I feel like that's what life is about. And we end up following somebody else's idea or ideas in our head. Like with the publicity that's come up, I sometimes find myself stressing about that. Like, wow, now I have to live up to something. When the idea is just to do whatever, be myself.
Yeah, now you're an icon, right? It's interesting because the way Mark writes about your the way you were thinking about religion, that they in any faith, that people had taken Jesus, for example, and taking him out of reality, I think is how Mark puts it, that he got from you, and made him a thing, right? And now you're a thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, this is the point. Like, I feel like money and – this is why I don't say money is evil necessarily, because it's the same as language. It symbolizes something else.
Yeah.
It doesn't symbolize itself. And – this, the idea of idolatry, we create images in our heads or ideas, and then we start revering or hating ideas rather than reality. This is kind of how I started feeling better about like negative comments that people that didn't even know me were making. They just have this idea. I feel like if all of us just saw reality and we saw each other as we are instead of this idea, then a lot of conflict that we see in the world would not exist. You know, you see that in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
Like, the idea was to make the Jews into this horrific monster, and then people could hate them. But if they actually saw them for who they are, humans, then I feel like it's impossible for one human to hate another. But we hate ideas. And if the flip side is worship, they're like two ends of the spectrum, or a swinging pendulum. It's like we worship an idea rather than a person. So we might revere what we think is a person, but it's an icon, that's idea. And that's what we do with religious figures. Like, that's why people don't practice Jesus' teachings, is because they're worshiping an icon rather than actually seeing a human being there, an icon in heaven.
You pushed the accelerator pedal on that car, and then you survived. And, you know, it seems miraculous that you did. But Mark Sundin explains in the book that you don't really see it as a miracle. So how do you explain what happened? You got lucky.
Well, I don't see it as a miracle in the way that we think of miracles.
Like God's hand coming down and...
The idea is that I see everything as a miracle. There's nothing that's more miraculous than another thing. Like, everything is. And we have this idea that this is a miracle and this is not. This is mundane and this is sacred or whatever. But I feel like it's all God. Or
it's all, astounding,
yeah,
right?
It's all that, yeah. Yeah, and that was no more miraculous than waking up in the morning, in my eyes. It's just, but I'm not saying that's not a miracle.
Yeah. Mark Sandin, let me ask you. It's like what's interesting about Daniel here, we're going to talk about you right in front of you, Daniel, but is you get this kind of mythic impression then of Daniel in some ways, and then he'll do something that throws you off. And you write about there are a couple of moments. I mean, he'll break the mood with a joke, or there's one particular thing where I'm starting to think in my mind as I'm reading this book that he's this, you know, ascetic who only – and he does have – you know, doesn't eat very much. I mean, that's sort of part of his belief, I suppose. But then he offers you a gummy bear. You know what I mean?
Right.
To talk about that, because he's not what you expect, I guess.
Right. My favorite lines in the book is something that a story that Daniel related where he was debating a Christian and she said, "What, do you think you can live like Jesus?" And he said, "Well, yeah, don't you? Isn't that the point of being a Christian?" And I think what's interesting is that, yeah, we put these religious figures onto a pedestal and worship them as if they're absolutely pure. But of course, these people also walked on earth and they were human beings. And so, you know, Daniel never claims to be the Messiah or to be like Jesus or to be a prophet or to be enlightened, anything like that. But here's someone who's actually taking these things seriously, these ideas seriously, and it blows people away and they think, oh my gosh, he must be an avatar or something like that. But he's not. He's just this guy that lives in a cave and eats gummy bears, you know? And he's living a life that's actually absolutely committed to religious ideals, but that doesn't make him something other than a human being.
Yeah.
Well, when I first started doing this, I was more of a hermit. I spent more time up in the canyon. I wanted to understand nature more perfectly, yeah. And I don't really know why. That's just what I did.
Sure.
And then as time went on, I spent more time in town. Like now I feel like I'm a total townie. I kind of miss the staying up in the cave for long periods. I'll stay up there a night or two, and then I have another camp near town. But I really do like hanging out with friends, and I feel like ultimately, this is about community, and ultimately, it's about face-to-face community. I have to catch myself because I start putting more importance on the blog and website than I do on just face-to-face, because I feel like these things, like basically bottom line, life is about loving our neighbor as ourselves, but we're loving everybody but our neighbor. We love people overseas. We love political figures or religious or whatever. We love
people at a distance.
Yeah. Or Facebook or whatever, and it's removing us from each other.
We should mention Mark Sandin, as you do in the book. I mean, the book, a good part of the book is about Daniel's relationship with his family, and he maintains a good relationship with them. They quibble about theological things, of course. But you talk about how I love this. They've said that Daniel has taken the Bible and spiritualized it.
Right, and I think you have to be someone who spends a lot of time debating theology to understand that that's a bad thing, to spiritualize the Bible from a certain perspective. But what surprised me most, I think, before I met Daniel's parents was I assumed that since they were conservatives that they'd be really disappointed and perhaps ashamed of having a son who decided to be homeless and not have a job. And as I got to know them, I realized that when you live a life that's so close to the Bible and thinking about it literally, this idea of going off and eating locusts and honey and getting rid of your possessions and going into the desert, it's not all that strange. And so for my family, for instance, where I was more concerned with getting into a good college and being a success and sort of fulfilling my potential, that would have been far more foreign.
Let me ask you this finally, Daniel, to you. Do you feel like this experiment will end at some point, that you've accomplished what you want to, and you could go back to money having accomplished that? Or do you think it's forever?
Well, I don't envision going back to money. The idea seems absurd to me, but I haven't made any vows. But I don't see any reason why I would go back.
That was Daniel Suelo. And we continue with a radio adaptation of the film Money as Debt, Part 3.